Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Hello, hello. Welcome back. Taxation is theft. Of course. What's going on, guys? I see some of you guys are starting to tune in. We are, of course, live on Facebook. If you normally watch the show on a podcast or on YouTube, head over to the Facebook page because that's actually where we do the live streams. We haven't been able to get it live on Google yet for technical reasons, but this is where we do the show live every Wednesday, usually around 6 or 7 p.m. Eastern. If you want to get in and you want to ask live questions and see all the fun, exciting stuff, comment and all that. Anyways, I have today Andrew Kern, who is the author of The Myth of the Social Contract, a new book that's out that sounds really exciting. Andrew, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about this book. Do you have to sign a contract to get it?
No, I don't think so. At least not an explicit one. Maybe an implied contract. No, it's kind of a collection of the most common arguments that I've heard, through talking to people online and in person about how just the common person tries to justify government authority. You know, so I don't try and deal with like arguments that philosophers have made, but just I think things that usually come to people's mind when you say things like taxation is theft, you know?
Awesome. So this is could be a very useful toolbox for using in your arguments online fighting against statists.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Awesome. I like one example would be like people say just taxation is the price we pay for civilized society. And so I have, I think two whole chapters devoted to just that. So. Yeah, I think it could be pretty helpful.
Awesome. Well, let's hear some like cool kind of excerpts or topics or rebuttals that you've got.
Well, let's see. The thing I start out in the first chapter is I point out that people there's a lot of different theories that people will have, right? But most of them will be like things like, you know, we all agreed to something, you know, to obey government rules, or we all agreed to, yeah, just we all agreed to something. But the thing is that the what people say is always a little bit different, you know? And so it's kind of a contradiction right there, is that the claim is that we agreed to something or other, but when people are asked what it is, they all have a little bit different idea of what the so-called agreement is, you know? Right. And so it's, I just describe that as just, that's just like a glimpse into the many problems that come with social contract theory.
Right. And that's interesting, because I've been thinking a lot the last couple of weeks just about, you know, definitions and how they're used in political arguments. For example, if you were to ask anybody in the country, I'm sure 99.999999% of them would say murder is wrong, theft is wrong, all these other things. But then when you look at like the abortion debate, people are trying to set a definition of what murder is. Or when you talk about taxes, they're trying to change the definition of what theft is based on, well, you know, yeah, taking things without permission is theft, unless it fits into this category of these certain things that I have grown to have a belief for. And for some reason, well, no, taxes aren't theft but aren't they taking it without your permission? Yeah, but we need it. Oh, so it's necessary and that makes it not theft. So if I were starving, it would be okay for me to steal. No, but like, and so, and of course some people would say, well, yeah, or it depends. You know, and they take this concrete definition of a word, and then they start to like say like, oh yeah, but there's all these exceptions and exclusions, and like the definition turns into jello and just kind of, you know, shapes into whatever. So if everybody has a different picture in their mind of what a word means, how useless is the whole language?
Right. And just like you said, when people go into how, well, yeah, we need it, that right there, I mean, right there, they're just totally changing the discussion, you know?
Right.
Like, even if something is theft, you could still argue that, okay, but we need to do it, or maybe something really bad will happen, right? That maybe you don't, maybe that's a bad route to go, but you could argue that. So the first thing to establish is that, yes, it is theft, and so we probably should have some moral qualms against it, even if you want to argue later, well, maybe in this specific instance, we need to do it. And so to just jump right into, yeah, we need to do it, I mean, that's getting ahead of the gun, you know?
Right. And I think that's like the whole, like, that's like, if somebody does that, you've already smacked them into cognitive dissonance, because they're like, well, I can't say that it's not theft. Let me switch over to this, but we need it. And you're right. It is like a completely separate argument, but it's like for somebody who's, I guess, not prepared to defend it. I don't know if that's cognitive dissonance or if it's just being unprepared. Cause I've seen the same thing where, you know, you get into an argument and someone will say, well, yeah, but this, and then you say, well, no, that's wrong, because, and then you drop some facts on them and then they totally change and say, well, yeah, but then this. And like, you know, time after time, and like you strike down every single one of those. It's like the Chris Farley meme. No, that didn't happen.
It is like you say, it's just people like panic. And so they'll blurt out something. Yeah, but we need this. We need it, you know. And that's, like I said, that's, if we're talking about whether it's theft or not, that's not even part of the conversation. You just change the subject.
Right.
Yeah, so like the one really common thing that people, I think it just people just blurt it out because they're like panicked. They need to believe in the status paradigm, right? The one thing they'll shout is like, well, if you don't like it, leave, you know? And I spend like a whole chapter just on that. So I point out that, well, in the US, you can't just leave. I mean, you need to, well, anywhere, I mean, you can't just leave. You need to have the resources and you need to be in good physical shape, first of all. I mean, what if you were disabled? You couldn't just walk out and leave, right? But, and then there's, in the U.S., there's a, to renounce your citizenship is like $2,300, first of all. So, like, I think that just throws that whole idea out the window. But, like, I think for those of us who are talking about we would like to leave, like, the state, we're not talking about geography. We're talking about leaving the authority or the political realm. And so that's a completely different thing.
Right.
And I think that's not allowed in pretty much every state. But I think like Liechtenstein allows that at least down to like a village level, but that's like the one state in the world that does.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting way to put it. So the next time somebody tells you, well, if you don't like it, just leave, you can say, well, I'm trying to leave the authority. I'm just not trying to leave the geographical region of imaginary lines.
Can't I keep my house and be around my friends and family and still leave? I mean, that's what you're trying to do.
Right.
I want to leave. Avoiding that whole conversation.
I want to leave and take this big plot of dirt with me. But yeah, that's like, so that's an interesting issue, because like you have like, I've always been fascinated with this like Disneyland, we could call it Disneyland philosophy. If, you know, let's say for example Disneyland is private property, right? And you know, when you go into Disneyland, that like, okay, you're not going to live there. You're expected to leave. It's private property. You have a contract with them when you buy your ticket, and you're expected to live by all their rules and authorities. But if they were to say, okay, well, we're going to expand Disneyland into, let's call it a sovereign nation, where you can actually, they'll build housing and you can move in there and they have taxes, but by moving in there, you're voluntarily agreeing to these taxes and everything else. You could argue, well, that's fine because you agreed to that. But then what happens when you start having kids and now those kids are growing up and you teach them, you brainwash them into believing, well, that's just the way things are. We've been here for, you know, maybe your parents are like, well, we've lived in Disneyland for three generations now. That's just the way things are. And if you don't like it, you can leave. And of course, that's totally different because leaving Disneyland is like, you know, a 10-minute walk versus leaving the United States is, you know, a boat ride, a plane trip, and, you know, all these other things. And then you're going into somebody else's controlled territory and everything else. But I think the most fascinating part of that is, what about these kids who are now growing up, which is the same as having a kid in the United States? Even if I personally signed the U.S. Constitution or swore an oath to the U.S. Constitution, and I am part of this actual physical, literal social contract, what right do I have to force my kids to be a part of that contract also? And I think that's where it kind of starts to fall apart.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good point. The whole kid thing. Yeah. And the thing is, if you want to argue that like kids somehow implicitly consented, then I think you're really getting into some dangerous waters because then you have to be consistent. You have to say that they're capable of signing contracts and capable of actual informed consent. And if you want to do that, I mean, that means kids will be able to do a lot of things that most people wouldn't think is appropriate, you know? So I don't think you want to go that route.
Right. Yeah. And that's an interesting argument too, because I know a lot of people go into the perverse world of pedophiles to talk about age of consent. But if you're just talking about contracts, I mean, how many people send their kids to the store growing up, I used to hear stories about like, oh yeah, we used to send our kids to the grocery store and they could buy cigarettes and alcohol for us and it wasn't a big deal. That's a contract, right? You're sending the kid to go engage in a contract, or even if it's their own money that they earned their allowance and they want to buy a stick of gum. That's a contract. They have property and they're making decisions on what to do with that. Now, of course, you know, you wouldn't ask a 5-year-old to make a decision on, hey, should you borrow, you know, should you take out a $50,000 loan and start a business? Probably, you know, they're not equipped to handle that yet. But at the same time, you have 30, 40, 50 year olds who will do the same thing and they'll make bad decisions and they'll totally fail. So, you know, what does that really mean? How, like, was the government right in saying people under the age of 18 don't have the right to consent to contracts? Or should there be some like mental ability test to say like, you know, oh, once you can pass this magical quiz, you are now approved by the government to engage in contracts legally?
Right. So I think it's a spectrum. We have to treat kids with, you know, as they'll get more developed, they're able to handle their own property and make limited contracts, like, you know, a simple transaction in a store. But the thing is, like a thing like a social contract, which says something like, I agree to obey the government forever and pay taxes forever in exchange for protection or whatever, that's like one of the most complex contracts there could be, you know? And so that you would think at least that would be reserved for a fully grown adult.
Right. Yeah. And what's interesting too is, you know, with any contract, right, you have a dispute. Oh, somebody wasn't, you know, the other guy breached the contract. He wasn't following the rules. You have a concrete contract that somebody agreed to with all of the rules explicitly spelled out. And with the government, it's like, for one, it's written in legalese, which I guess most contracts are anyway. But when you look at like the law and how it changes and how nobody's even had an opportunity to read through it before they're forced to agree to it, I think that spins the whole thing in another crazy direction.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Since a contract, like a social contract, is such a complex thing, like, and such a serious thing, you would think it would be completely written out and all the details would be spelled out, you know, of what it is we're agreeing to, but there's nothing like that. And there's just no agreement. Obviously, there's no explicit right. agreement. It's always taken as something that's implied, which, you know, you can understand how simple things can be implied, like going onto someone's property and saying you'll agree to leave if they don't want you there. Okay, that's pretty simple. But, like, all the things that the government expects of us and all the taxes we're expected to pay, that's just not simple at all. And then also, like you said, they also have the unilateral power to change the rules as it goes. So, and most people don't even know what it is they're all obligated to do. There are so many regulations, and you know, people are breaking laws without even knowing it all the time. It's not even possible to live up to those obligations that we supposedly have.
Right. And there's a book I'm reading right now. I was just looking for, Three Felonies a Day. And it's, you know, like I'm reading through this and like, I kind of already know, like there's all kinds of things like, you know, you're violating a gaming license or something, or you know, like a fish license, and you caught too many fish, or you caught a lobster that was under 3 inches, or, you know, whatever, like some rules you don't even know that turn out to be felonies. And you know, and then you look at some of the vague ones like money laundering. Like anybody in this entire country could be convicted of money laundering just because those rules are so vague. It's absolutely insane.
Yeah, well, I've been meaning to read that actually, and I've cited that statistic a few times that just the average person will break three felonies or more a day.
Yeah,
that's pretty crazy.
It's really interesting. So I got a question here from Steve. He's asking, what do you think about the fact that most people are forced to work so they can't be home to protect their families and home? So they kind of need police to protect those things while they are away. I don't agree with it, by the way, but that's a lot of statist arguments.
Okay.
That's what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, most people can't be on security detail, you know, all the time. And I don't think they would need to be. So one of the things that's a government, most people want government to do is provide security. And that's one of the ideas is we give up our taxes and some freedoms in exchange for the government providing security. But that doesn't mean, I would argue that most of the security at least in the US and probably other countries is provided privately already. First of all, people, you know, you're not always at threat from someone stealing your private property. Most people do respect our norms. It's not that they respect the laws, they respect norms that it's your house, and people are well aware that regardless of what the law is, that they're doing something wrong by breaking into your house. But also, there's things like privately owned guns, which there's hundreds of millions in the US. There's private security, privately hired security, which actually outnumber government police by quite a bit. I think at this point, it's almost double private security personnel than there is police. There is neighborhood watch groups, which volunteers who patrol their neighborhoods. It's actually around 40% of people in the U.S. live in a neighborhood with a watch group, and the fact that those neighborhoods that they're in, that's been correlated with lower crime. And let's see, I was reading, was it Bruce Benson's book, Serve and Protect? I didn't include this stat in the book, but just because I just saw it, but it's actually, and this is, I think it was about 20 years old, the stat is, but private expenditures on security are three times as high as government expenditures on police and jailing. So I think that's, obviously, you can't tell everything from expenditures, but I think there's a good argument to make that most of the security and law and order, so to speak, are already provided by private sources.
Yeah, I think a lot of that sounds right. There's like, I was reading about a little town that used to, they used to pay the sheriff to come patrol like their, I think it was a gated community. They used to pay them to come patrol it because they were starting to get some break-ins and other things. And they didn't like that. They didn't like what they were paying, and they didn't like how the police were acting. So they went and hired a private security firm, which ended up costing them something like a third less. And it actually reduced their crime rate because they were there more often, and they were actually stopping people. So it's like, it's really interesting to see that private does work better. But also, it's like, what's really interesting is, and I think the statistic is something like 50% of America lives in urban areas or metropolitan or, you know, big cities. And then the other half is more like rural. And when you get out, I don't know exactly which part is, you know, how many people are in incorporated cities, but it's got to be, you know, it's pretty close to half. And what people in big cities don't realize is when you live out there, you don't have a local police department. You might have a sheriff who might be a half an hour to an hour away. You might have one sheriff who's overseeing an entire county, who's got a couple deputies. Maybe it's very sparsely populated. Maybe he's dealing with another problem that when someone breaks into your house, it's a half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours a day before they ever show up to do anything. So it's, you know, you protect yourself. And yeah, you can't always be at home, but you know, whether it's your job or not, like, it doesn't matter. Like, you want to go on vacation, you want to go visit a friend's house, whatever it is, you leave your house alone. Yes, see if you can hire a private security. And if you're out in the middle of nowhere, and maybe that's going to be really expensive or not likely, you know, do whatever you can, put up cameras, do all this other stuff. And very worst case scenario, like, you know, bury your gold in your backyard. Get insurance. So if somebody does break in and they steal your TV or whatever else, it's covered. You have insurance and they're going to replace it, which, by the way, the police will not do. They'll come in, they'll write a report. Okay, he lost his TV and some other stuff. But they're not going to get your TV back.
Yeah. Well, by far the most reported crime is vehicle theft. I mean, and it's not even close. There, most other crimes have fairly low reporting rates. I don't have the numbers on me, but vehicle theft is like 90% or more. And why do you think that is? It's because there's insurance on vehicles. We already have a somewhat developed private market for that. And so if people, whereas most other crimes, everything is mostly handled through the government, and police are not very good at tracking down criminals and getting your stuff back. Whereas, even though it's kind of a distorted market, the private insurance is, but there's still, people understand that if they can report it, well, I think what it is they're required to report it in order to collect insurance. I don't know if that's a law in some states or not, but that is what's motivating it. And you can see just a huge difference, like I said, in the reporting rates.
Right. And there's all kinds of technology that was created by the private market, of course. Not, the police didn't come up with LoJack or these other, you know, GPS things. And like, I've seen these too now, where like you can put, there's like a little GPS thing, you can charge it up and stick it in your kid's backpack. So if your kid ever gets abducted, you can find him on GPS. Or if, you know, you lose your, you can put them on your dog. You can put them in your wallet, or, you know, somebody steals your backpack or your purse or something, whatever. You can do all these really amazing things. And, what's really interesting, and even like, you know, iPads and iPhones and everything have that built in. And what's really interesting is I've heard stories of people where, you know, they get their iPad stolen. They go to the police and say, hey, look, somebody stole my iPad. I know exactly where it is. I have the, you know, find my iPad thing. Go get it for me. And the police are like, sorry, we've got more important things to do. We've got traffic tickets to give and all this other stuff. And so,
oh, that's just not the police's primary motivation. I mean, what incentive do they have to track down a stolen item and return it to you? They don't. They're not going to get a raise because of that. They're not going to get paid better. They'll be treated the same way no matter what they do. Why would they do it?
Right. And now if you have insurance on it, you could potentially get it back. If we didn't have police and you had, you know, let's say private security that maybe you could hire and say, hey, that's mine, hire somebody who would go collect it for you, then, you know, there's that. And it might cost you a little bit, but that's kind of like, okay, does it cost more than the iPad? Maybe not. Maybe it costs like $100 for somebody to go try to get it. You know, you got to figure out what your payoff is. And maybe, okay, yeah, $100, $200, yeah, that's too much, but maybe the insurance is a lot less. So it's, yeah, it's really like we have so many options available. And if you like one option better than the other, like, pick that option. Like, you're right. Free to choose.
Right. And it's that competition that is what makes the difference. You know, if we are hiring our own security agency or agency that will return stolen loot, and then they did a crap job, then we could go to somewhere else. You know, as with police, we don't have that option. There's not a lot we can do. And so because of that, then private firms are motivated to do that job well and, you know, actually find stolen stuff.
Right. I'm on Amazon right now, and I've got the link for your book. I'm going to post it in the comments for anybody who wants to go get it. So it looks like the book is free if you're on Kindle, or for $8
I think if you have Prime, it's free.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's $3.99 on Kindle.
Oh, yep, I see that. Amazon's just trying to fucking upsell me again.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'm posting this, and then yeah, for what is it, $8 or $9, you can get $8, you can get the paperback shipped to you. So so yeah, this looks like a pretty awesome book. I guess let's talk about you. What's your history? How did you get into this stuff?
Arguing on the internet mainly.
I mean, like, did you always, were you always, well, let me ask this. Do you consider yourself an anarchist, a libertarian, minarchist, voluntarist?
A libertarian and anarchist. I usually use the term market anarchist. Anarcho-capitalist works as well, but I think there are people who use that term that I wouldn't agree with about everything, but.
Definitions, right? They have a different definition of what capitalism is evil. Always. That's the reason I used to call myself ANCAP, but because of that, I started using voluntarist because it's, I see not the flaws of capitalism, but I see how capitalism is associated with the people who the fraudsters who thrive in a capitalist world, the people who take advantage of that particular system, it's associated with them and not with all of the amazing things that come from it. So yeah, I prefer voluntarist, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So when I think of capitalism and without any state connection, so if it's like a stateless capitalism, which I think is certainly possible, that what I think that means is that there's a free market, but then there's, what characterizes capitalism is that there are like firms with employees and employers and like landlords with tenants. Whereas there have been some like individualist anarchists who have argued that the employer-employee relationship is too hierarchical. And so they would say that's statist, and whereas, you know, ANCAPs typically don't. And so I guess I'm just not stuck on one or the other. I'm okay with like a market developing where there is an employer-employee relationship, and it'd be fine if then there was another region there wasn't, where employees owned all the firms cooperatively. So
right.
I'm okay going either way and whatever. So that's why I like market anarchists, because I'm okay with the market going either way or a number of different ways.
Interesting. Yeah, that's one that, you know, I always get is that, you know, workers are being exploited and that. And it's not necessarily true, but I can see, I mean, like in today's world, like that idea, I've come to realize recently that there is an exploitation there, but it's not because somebody wants to work for an employer in exchange for money. It's because you're basically being forced through taxes to have to earn a living. Like, there's no, like, you can't just pick your land and be self-sustainable like you used to be able to. It's no, you got to pay property tax. So get your ass out there and, you know, get a job so you can be a productive member of society, which, you know, the courts, you know, is whenever you break one of their little rules, they always like push you. Okay, well, we'll let you stay on probation if you get a job and gain full employment and like all this other shit. And it's like they're pushing you into this, and they're creating like a surplus market pool of laborers, of people who are forced to get a job. And when you do that, then it's like, you know, everybody's begging for a job. And then, of course, the employers can exploit that and say, well, we're going to pay you less because there's so many people trying to take this job. Whereas, you know what, like 50 years ago, women pretty much didn't work. So that's like half of the workforce gone. And now it's like you've got everybody's working. You've got relationships with two parents that both have jobs just to pay the bills. And some of them are still squeaking by. So I think like all of these taxes and systems and everything that are in place, I think that's the exploitation, not the relationship between the employer and the employee.
Yeah. The exploitation theory, I think, ultimately relies on the labor theory of value, which is completely defunct, in my opinion. And so I don't take that seriously. But I do respect that people could have, even in a completely free market, in a stateless society, people could take the view that they are being exploited, you know, by employers. And so if it was a really common view, then people would just they wouldn't be forced to work, like you're pointing out, by the state, and they would tend to form worker-owned cooperatives, you know, instead. And so I just don't think you could call that capitalism necessarily if there's not like that capital relationships and those capitalist relationships of employer-employee, but that can still be a free market. On the other hand, I could say, you could argue that capitalism allows for that, you know, because it allows for people to make whatever decisions they want in the market.
Right. Yeah, that's the I don't know what you would call that. If we have a society that's largely anarcho-capitalist, you could still create little, you know, communist communes, I guess you would call them, or, you know, socialist micro societies inside of that, and that would be absolutely fine. And they could, you know, share their resources and labor and split their time growing crops and whatever, or, you know, building whatever they build, and then trading that with capitalist societies outside of it. I think the most important part is that if you do that, you're not forcing people into that system. It's people who want to participate in that type of society are welcomed in and free to leave whenever they want. And I think that's, you know, in capitalism, I think, you know, except for the things we just talked about, I think that's largely the idea. Of course, we've seen people try that where, like, there have been some restaurants that were supposed to be like, you know, communist type restaurants where they were all owned by the workers. They still charged for the food. And I'm not sure exactly how that worked out, but basically these businesses always fail. Now, I don't know if it's because they just don't have the experience that it takes to run the business, or they're taking into account the labor theory, and they're like, well, if we all just, you know, work the right number of hours, then things will work out. And they forget to account for having a manager and a marketing department and everything else. You know, people who are specialized in these different areas to make sure that there's enough business. Then, you know, it really just all kind of falls apart. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
Yeah. I just think the biggest thing that like a typical firm brings to the table, where there's an employer, an employee, and everybody in between, is that there's division of labor within the firm. So in a worker-owned cooperative, you have to be, you know, on the floor doing your job, and then you also have to, you're voting and participating in the management of the firm. So you kind of have to know how to do everything. And who is going to be, most people aren't going to be able to do it all those things well. Whereas if you're splitting up jobs and some people is taking more of a leadership role and some people are, you know, taking entry level roles, then people are able to specialize and become better. And so I think that's the main reason why those type of firms would outcompete worker-owned cooperatives. But like you said, people should be free to try either or anything in between.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting too because you have, I mean, I guess if you play out that whole scenario, you can totally see why somebody is paid more to manage one. So like, let's say for example, you've got two restaurants. They're mostly let's say they're mostly like all the employees are, you know, they know how to run the restaurant and everything else, but not a single person in either restaurant knows how to do marketing. Then a marketing person comes along and says, okay, look, you guys are just barely making a profit, right? You're let's just say you're breaking even. Exactly. Both restaurants are doing the same. But this person comes along and says, look, I know you guys want to be able to take some money home and you want to be able to, you know, whatever, have some disposable income. I can do that for you because I know how to advertise. Now, I'm going to do this for you as a service. And because of that, I want, you know, if I can make you $1 million in the next year, I want 20% of it. And now this person's making 200 grand a year. Well, shit, that's a lot of money compared to everybody else who's making $5 or $10 an hour. But at the same time, right now, all those people are still only making $5 or $10 an hour. If this person comes in and says, hey, like, okay, between these two restaurants, I'm gonna have a bidding war. Whoever wants to take my deal can take it. You know, one restaurant is gonna say, well, he's promising he's gonna make us $1 million. It's worth it for us to do that. And that's why they're paying so much, because, you know, maybe it starts out, you know, it's the highest bidder and that's just how they pick, right? You give me 5%. Oh, you'll give me 10%. Oh, you'll give me 15%. Okay, fine. Until it's up to 20%. And then that's why this person, because they realize how important that person is. Now this person goes to work for one of those restaurants. They make $1 million. This person gets 200 grand that they get to walk away with, but there's also another 800 grand that the business made, which is going to the employees in some bonuses and some other stuff. And maybe it's not like, you know, 100 grand each, but it's still more money than they would have had if they didn't hire this person and give them all that money. And so, yes, a lot of those employees are going to be looking up to that person like, man, I wish I could make 200 grand a year. But the reality is, any of those people, if they went out to learn that skill and learn to be like that person and do what they do, could leave and go to the other restaurant and say, I'm going to now bring this extremely valuable skill to you and you're going to make a lot of money and I'm going to make a lot of money. And it's I don't see how anybody can look at that and say that's not fair.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, there's just a lot to be said that for the fact that you'll earn what you agree to get paid. I think, I don't know, for some reason, like socialists or communists will say, well, don't put a lot of stock in that. But I just don't think you can deny that there's some moral weight there. I mean, if you agree to get paid something, it's work. It's important that you get paid that.
Right. And I've seen that in small businesses too. Like people get pissed off, like, you know, they find out somebody's getting paid more and all of a sudden there's like mutiny and everybody's like, you know, well, let's fire that person because they're a waste, or they like business has picked up. Let's fire the expert because we don't need them anymore because we're making lots of money. And then as soon as the expert's gone, your sales start going back down and it's like, oh my God, what happened? I think it's just that. It's like a failure to grasp, you know, the sum of the parts kind of thing.
Yeah, and the other thing is that in a market economy, the wages that you earn should trend towards the value that you're bringing into the company. Because if you're bringing in more, let me think, if you're bringing in more but not making a lot, then there's going to be competition. Other firms will take you away, so you'll go make more money for them, or if you're making more than you're bringing into the firm, then or that's when firms will pull you away. But like, it's just competition is balances it out. So yeah, so I mean, that's, it's a pretty understood phenomenon by both Austrian economists and neoclassical economists that person's wages in the long run at least will tend towards being close to what they're bringing to the company.
Right. Man, so yeah, so that's interesting how people don't, I don't know. But you know, I think usually they're usually thinking emotionally, and you know, and look, you got to agree with them when they say, like, you know, I'm just trying to fix the world's poverty problems. Well, yeah, like, there's problems in the world, and yeah, it would be great to find solutions to them, but you just have to realize, like, okay, but yeah, this is like unicorns and pie in the sky. This is like, this isn't the right answer to those problems.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's not easy to sell that we should just like do nothing, you know, that we should let the market work. That's seems like people's natural inclination is we need to interfere. And the easiest thing, well, it's not that easy, but the most obvious way to interfere is with the government. And so that's always a temptation that's there.
Right. Yeah. And that's a really interesting thing with like libertarian politicians that, you know, like, and I see this in my own campaign, like when you talk to people about, yeah, we're just not going to do anything, like we're just going to like leave you alone, to most people that's like so what are you going to do? It's like it's the concept of not doing anything is like it's really kind of hard to grasp. But if you go in there and say, we're going to cut taxes, we're going to allow businesses to thrive, we're going to allow employees to get paid more because they're not getting their paychecks fleeced, like when you reframe it into like what we're going to do, then for some reason it just clicks and it makes more sense, and then everybody's like, oh, okay, I can deal with that, that's cool.
Yeah, we're gonna allow people to make things better, we're gonna get out of their way, you know.
Yeah, it's just funny how that works. It's like, it's the human mind, and it's a complex machine. It's funny how it works. So what other kind of stuff you have in this book?
I try to establish, especially in the latter half, how like law and order and, well, I guess just order and like rules and such are injustice. They don't really originate with the state. There's a lot that goes on outside of the state, even currently in the era where states are huge and powerful. And there's been historical instances when governments weren't really involved, where there were private, you know, alternatives that stepped in to create order. And so I just think it's a huge mistake to go the route of that there'll be chaos without the state. I don't think it's supported by any evidence. So right. Like one example would be the Western frontier, American Western frontier. There are a ton of different types of private alternatives that people use to create order. It's like people were moving west faster basically than the government could keep up. And so there was obviously a need for some security and for justice. And it's not like nothing happened. A lot of people, you know, they desired that service. And so then they went and got it. You know, for like, so in San Francisco, there was like 1849, I think it was, the population had grown from like just 100 people to 20,000 in just a few years. And so obviously there hadn't really been any, there was kind of a small government, but there were only like a few police officers and they were all entirely corrupt anyway. And so people just hired private security. They, shop owners would like hire secure or people to patrol the streets, and people would hire people to patrol the the roads around their houses to just watch for fire. That was probably the main thing, to watch for fires and then also watch for robbers. And so that's actually, you probably might have heard of the San Francisco Private Police. It's still around, but it's kind of a lot more involved with the government police now. But that was founded in San Francisco in 1849 or 50, just because they're, you know, people don't devolve into chaos when there isn't a government. They're not stupid.
Right. And that's really interesting. Interesting model. 'Cause let's say, for example, I'll use this example. I see this here in Mexico. There are stores that people will get robbed on their way to their car, right? So they go into the store, they do their shopping, they leave. And of course, like, okay, yeah, they have security to protect the store. But then on your way to your car, you get robbed and they take the things you just bought or they take your wallet, whatever else. Well, like, okay, so the store has, like, people will say, yeah, but the store has incentive to protect itself, but not the community around it. But that's not true at all. And what we see is that they have their security actually patrol, like, further out now, the parking lots and everything else. And they could go a little bit further, like the example you just gave in San Francisco, because if people don't feel safe going all the way to this big store, they're just going to shop at, you know, whichever one else is a little bit safer, because they want to feel safe where they're doing their shopping. So the store that provides that type of security, not just in the store, but around the store to make sure you can get to your car, or maybe it's like a two block radius, they make sure that there are police. So, you know, then that store, not only is, you know, are they protecting their store and their customers, but they're earning a reputation that's going to help their customers have a higher respect for them, spend more money there and everything else. So it's like there's plenty of incentive for private businesses and organizations to do these types of things. We don't need some government to stick a gun to our head and say, give me your money so that I can hire people to keep you safe. That's absolutely insane.
Oh yeah, that's what competition will do. Obviously, a store that's safer, and if you're able to get there and get to your car with your groceries, your customers are going to appreciate that. Obviously, they're going to have an advantage over a store where that's not as possible, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. But it's like, I don't know, I guess it really comes down to, like, you know, what's, people only know what they've seen and experienced, and until people start to see and experience new things and new ways of solving these problems, which of course the government doesn't like, right? They already have their monopoly. It's already provided. Why would you want to create some other way? But once people are able to see how those other things work and see working examples of them, it's amazing how they'll say, like, oh yeah, well, I'm totally down for saving money and not getting robbed and living in a safer world. We just gotta figure a way to show them that.
Yeah, it is tough because we're so far into more and more things are done through the government now, and so we rely on it so heavily. So it's really hard to show that things are even possible without it. But I still think there's an opportunity there. Like, even if something as basic as security, there's so much that it's provided privately now, even with how big the government is. I think there's a lot we can point out there.
Yep. So I wanted to ask you earlier, like, you came up with a lot of this information from arguing with people on the internet, but what, like, were you always kind of the ANCAP or the market capitalist? Did you ever follow a different philosophy, and did you fall into this, and was there like a pivotal moment of understanding?
Yeah, well, I wasn't really interested in politics at all until like 5 years ago. And I think when I first got into it, I was basically basic conservative, which is a little embarrassing. But it wasn't too long where I kind of went more libertarian. And then I was a minarchist for a little while, and then I kind of followed right that, you know, the path right into anarcho-capitalism. And then since then, it kind of broadened out a little bit. I've, Yeah, I've come to think of anarchism in a different way, I think, than most like ANCAPs would. And so I think I've kind of, yeah, so that's why I kind of call myself a market anarchist now.
Was there any like pivotal moment? Like, did you hear like Ron Paul speaking, or did you get arrested, or did you like witness something, or get robbed by the IRS, or I don't know, so anything like that?
I wasn't a Ron Paul guy. I only found him actually after I had, I think I was a full on anarchist by the time I even found him, but which it was great. It was awesome going back and finding some of his, like finding him in debates, some of the clips, they're awesome. But no, it was mostly, no, I live a pretty quiet life. I'm out in the country, so don't run into cops much anyway. So no, it was all pretty much like intellectual, I guess. And
right.
Arguments, well, I guess, and thinking about things.
So, but you're kind of living, well, I don't want to assume, but you're like, how far out in the country are you? And is there a lot of government where you are, or is that kind of like, how, like you've experienced, like you walk outside and there aren't police patrolling your streets, so you feel like you're at least away from government for the most part?
Yeah, I'm only like 4 miles just south of a town that's like has 25,000 people. So I mean, the only time I run into cops is I just see them on the street sometimes and out looking to take money from people.
Right. Awesome. Cool. All right, man. Well, I'm really excited about this book. I've got the link. So for anybody watching, the link is, if you're watching the live stream, the link is in the comments, but I will post it in the description. And also we're going to have it in the description if you're watching this on YouTube. Is there anything else you want to hit us with? Any websites, anything you want to promote, upcoming events, book signings, you know, anything?
Oh, I run the Principled Libertarian Facebook page. And then there's a website, principledlibertarian.com. So you can check out both of those. I do write some articles and stuff, and everything, pretty much everything. Well, the longer articles are going to be on the website. And then I do some blogging on Facebook. And actually the best way to get the book would go to principledlibertarian.com/social contract. And then there's a link there. So you can just do that too.
Awesome. Okay. All right. Well, it's been great having you on the show. Some interesting conversations, great ideas. Hopefully everyone out there who's watching obviously is on the internet. So now you have some great ammo. Go get the book so you can have some even more ammo to fight your online arguments. Thanks again for joining me tonight. It's been great talking with you, and we'll have you on again soon. And taxation is theft.
All right. Taxation is theft.
All right. I'll see you later.
See ya.
Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Rhodes.
You boys like